Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, Ted Oderico, and thank you for joining me again this evening, Thursday evening, July the 10th, here on blogtalkradio.com. As I indicated in the promo for this week, of course, we're going to take another break once again from Coach's Corner. And simply the reason I'm doing this, guys, to be quite honest, is a lot of you out there, I know a lot of the teaching pros and coaches that I've been dealing with, I just have some very busy schedules during the summer months. So it's always hard sometimes to coordinate time and scheduling and that. So obviously, if I can't get a panel together in time for the program, I'm going to have to omit it. But I'll always find something to plug in here, and believe you me, I have no problem in talking for an hour by myself, as you'll find out tonight. But anyways, I've got a great guest, of course, coming up a little bit later in the broadcast, Dr. Nick Molinaro. He's a sports psychologist, and he's going to be joining us, as well as actually one of the teaching professionals that's been on the show before, Brian Dobby, is going to be joining us when Nick is here as well. And also a gentleman I haven't spoken to, but another PGA from Germany and also mini tour player, Chris Trunzer, I believe is his name, and we'll talk to him as well. He'll be joining us a little bit later in the show. But just to remind everybody, of course, we're live on blogtalkradio.com at Golf Talk Live, and the easiest way to get there is you can type in your URL on your computer or iPhone, go to blogtalkradio.com and either /Golf Talk Live or up in the search key you can just type Golf Talk Live and it'll take you right to the show. And of course we're live every Thursday night from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. That's 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for you on the East Coast. Don't forget, if you want to call in and speak to me or any of my guests during the live broadcast on Thursday evenings, you can do so at area code 646-716-4667. That's area code 646-716-4667. You can speak to, again, either myself or any of the guests that are on the program. If you want to call in, just say hello. That'd be great. Also, you can email me questions or comments if you want about the program, or if you have somebody that has been on the program and you'd maybe like to have them come back again, you can certainly do so by emailing me personally at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. And don't forget, just because the Coach's Corner panel is not here tonight doesn't mean you need to stop sending in your questions. So keep the questions coming, and you can send those to questions.golftalklive@gmail.com. If you're wanting to get updates via social media, you can do so on Facebook. Visit the Golf Talk Live blog Facebook page and make sure that you like us while you're there. And feel free to post any comments or if you have questions about the program, you can certainly do so there. And that's at facebook.com/Golf Talk Live blog. Make sure that you have blog on the end of that. Also, you can follow me on Twitter. Appreciate all the new followers at Ted. My handle is Ted and Buck CEO. That's TEDANDBUCK, capital CEO. And also, don't forget to check out the Golf Talk Live website at www.golftalkliveblog.com. As I said, I'm going to be joined a little bit later on by sports psychologist Dr. Nick Molinaro. He's going to be coming on here. We're going to be talking about his role in helping some great athletes, and particularly, obviously, in golf. And he's a co-founder of the Vantage Sport Psychology Group, along with Dr. Chris Michaels. But Dr. Nick is going to be with us here in about an hour's time. But in the meantime, a few things I wanted to talk about tonight. Number one, I just wanted to, while I was mentioning about Coach's Corner, I said the last couple of programs, as you may recall, those of you tuning in, that I was going to be putting together a new series called Plan for Success, and in the midst of working on that right now. And what's going to entail on that, just for those of you that haven't tuned in, is there's going to be really seven parts to the series. First part being fitness for golf. We're going to talk about, have a great panel put together that specialize in the fitness end of golf, and talk about different things and ways that, to get in shape, and some of the proper exercises that are really sort of golf conducive, if you will. And then we're going to follow that up on another show with another group of panelists, and we're going to talk about nutrition. Now, a lot of people might say, well, what does nutrition have to do, and how is that going to help my golf game? Well, what goes into your mouth obviously helps fuel your body. And if you're putting a lot of garbage food in all the time, that doesn't mean you can't have snacks once in a while. But if you're constantly snacking and eating unhealthy food all the time, your body is going to show that in a multitude of ways. Obviously, you're more than likely going to be overweight and possibly in some cases even obese. But more importantly, you're not going to have the energy or the desire to really be very active. And also, you won't have the stamina. And golf, believe it or not, when you're playing 18 holes, does take stamina. It's a, you know, you're out there many times 4, 5, even 6 hours. And if you're playing, as I do down here in the southeast part of the United States, especially during the summer months, it gets quite hot. And if you're not fueling your body properly and nourishing it, then you're obviously going to feel the effects throughout your round. And it's just good health tips that we're going to be giving as well for this, but I think it's an important component that needs to be addressed. The third segment or part of the series is going to be practice. And what we're going to do is, again, we're going to have a panel of some great coaches that are going to be here. And we're going to talk about really how to put together a proper practice station, some of the proper ways to really work on your game, what is really sort of a priority in your game that you should be working on, how to decide what you should be working on is another way as well. We're going to try and do maybe an assessment right here on air and talk about some of the different things that we can do to help you put together a proper practice routine. And in other words, we want you to practice with purpose, as we've mentioned many times in the program. So that's going to be the third segment. Fourth segment, I'm going to get some people together as well. We're going to talk about on the panel about the equipment, not just the different types of equipment and what their purposes are, of course, but also how to be properly fitted and why you need to be properly fitted in order to get the best out of your golf game. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to have some people from the equipment end of it as well as some of the coaches. And also we're going to put in the fifth segment, we're going to put together some great teachers and some great psychologists and so forth together to talk about the mental side. I might even get Dr. Nick to come back on that one as well, but some of the mental gurus out there in the golf world, get them on the program as well and talk about the mental side, how to mentally prepare. And as Cindy Miller in our segment on the Women of Golf show puts it, how to own your game. And to truly own your game, you have to be in control of your mental capacity. So we're going to be talking about that in segment 5 of Plan for Success. And number 6, of course, is going to be instruction, talking about some of the different technology available in instruction, some of the techniques that are out there right now, and some of the new ones that are going to be coming out, and also some of the old ones and how they've been effective over the years. And once we've done all 6 of those, then on the 7th one, I'm going to have a select panel put together, and we're going to sort of put it all together. And we're going to go from point A to point B and help you to prepare to go out and play your best round of golf. In other words, plan for success. So you want to stay tuned for that. And that's going to be starting here in just a few short weeks. I'll give you the exact date, either the next show or the show after. I'm still sort of putting together the panel, but that's going to be part of the Coach's Corner Plan for Success series. And I think it'll be a good series, so I hope you guys will tune in. Make sure you start passing the word around tonight if you wish, and just let them know to tune into Golf Talk Live, and we're going to have some great stuff for you here. And just one other thing that I don't normally mention on the show very often, because I do post the show and that on so many different levels of social media. But if you want to follow the show, one of the great ways to follow it, you can either connect with me on Facebook or you connect with the program itself. But the other way to do it is if you go to www.blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive, that brings you up to the main page where on Thursday nights, of course, front and center will be the current live broadcast. But if you scroll down, you will see that there is an on-demand section. Now, if you want to be notified of upcoming broadcasts right to your inbox, your email inbox, on that same page, there is a follow button right below the heading there. And if you click on follow, what that will do is that will actually send you an email notification each and every week, the day of the show. And I believe it actually will send it out, if I'm not mistaken, it might even send it out the day before. But it definitely will send you an email reminder of what's coming up and who's going to be on the show directly to your inbox, so make sure that you will not forget to tune into Golf Talk Live. But as I said, we're on every Thursday evening, Central Standard Time at 6 p.m. here on blogtalkradio.com. And I certainly enjoy doing this broadcast, and I hope that you enjoy tuning in. And by all means, please pass the word along. And we have some great listeners from all over the world that tune in each and every week. And I want to thank you, as I do every show at the end. But I want to thank you again here at the beginning. I appreciate you tuning into the broadcast. So stay tuned for the Plan for Success series coming up on Coach's Corner here in the next few weeks. And as I said, I will keep you posted as to the date that will actually start and some of the players that will be involved. I wanted to talk about a couple things tonight while we have some time here before Nick comes on. And one of the things is about positive communication. And, you know, I was reading some interesting articles, and one sort of came to mind here, and it talks about teaching golf skills is really only one piece of being a good teacher or coach. And, you know, as we all have, we spend a lot of time speaking with clients about their coaches and teachers and their impact on their clients' performances. And outside of golf, it's sad to say many athletes do not have positive experiences with teachers and coaches. And part of the reason why is that teachers and coaches aren't necessarily chosen to teach and coach because of their fabulous people skills. Rather, and much similar to other jobs, people are hired to do a job, specific job for their technical skill or ability and or experience. And teachers are, and coaches are not are certainly no different. This doesn't mean that some teachers and coaches don't have the ability to be personable, caring, or supportive, but it does mean it's more than likely not the case. Olympic professional and elite teachers and coaches get paid to bring home the money or the gold, which again goes to not mean they necessarily have to be personable. Certainly don't get me wrong when I say this, but we need teachers and coaches with both technical skill and ability. But also we need teachers and coaches who understand how to work with people. And that's an important factor. You know, one of the things that I've always said, and I think most teachers and professionals would probably agree, coaches, that you have to develop a good relationship with your students. And or if you're working with a high-level player, you have to develop relationships with your players. And you aren't going to be able to help them with really the difficult part, which is the mental game, without that. So it's extremely important. And if you're only spending time on the mechanics of golf, then your players are missing out. Like you, they will attribute slicing and missing putts to not practicing enough, as an example, and that more likely is not their problem. Many golfers that I've worked with have practiced so much, it was as if they had a hard time, a part-time job alongside their full-time job. And after our work together, golfers certainly realize that they don't need to necessarily train longer, but they need to train mentally. As a teacher and coach, you know how mental golf is, and really the question is, why don't we address it more? And I think more and more we are in this industry, but it's something that really I think needs to come to the forefront. Fear is probably the biggest reason. And as an example, teachers or coaches may ask themselves, well, how do I address, you know, as an example, the yipes, which is a mental issue. Teachers and coaches don't always know how to address what's mental. One of the best ways to address mental challenges with a player is to develop a coaching philosophy that includes being positive, certainly affirming, supportive, and communicative. And certainly don't pretend that mental challenges don't exist, even if you don't exactly know how to help. Having the ability to talk about it and refer your player to someone who can help is certainly huge. So if you're not, in other words, if you're not somebody that really area. Maybe you're not a strong mental coach, let's say, as an example, that it might be in your best interest to find somebody who and work together on developing a better rounded player. So that's one of the things, that really I think needs to happen in the golf business. So what's one of the first steps as a teacher and coach? It's important to think about and develop your coaching philosophy. You may have never thought about this before, but your philosophy has a huge impact on a golfer's motivation and particularly determines how a successful player, they will become in self-awareness. And you can do that by asking yourself some of the following questions. First one off the top of my head is, who am I? What do I want in life? Where am I going? What are my goals? Why do I teach? Why do I teach or coach? Am I teaching or coaching for the right reasons? Am I a good teacher or coach? And be honest with your assessments. Really think about these questions. What would make me a better teacher or coach? Sometimes I think writing things down, in a manner, in questions like this and really sort of doing some soul searching helps us to become better coaches and or teachers. Some of the other things are, what are your goals as a teacher or coach? What is more important, winning or the student or athlete that you may be working with? Am I a command or cooperative teaching coach? And we'll talk about that here in just a moment. So, there's a lot of different questions that we as teacher professionals need to ask ourselves. And I think that, once we sort of do our own assessment, then we're going to be able to help our students that much better. And there's a lot of great teachers out there that are able to balance both the physical side of the game and the mental side of the game. And there's some that specialize in either or. And I, as I said a moment ago, what I would strongly urge those that maybe don't have a well-rounded package, in other words, you may be very proficient, in the physical side of golf, but maybe not so much in the mental side of golf. You may, or vice versa, you may want to consider, as I said, partnering up with somebody who shares your passion, but also shares some skills that maybe you don't have, and work together. There's no harm in working together. The more information that you absorb and learn, the better you're going to be able to articulate that and help your students. Your philosophy also helps determine what kind of a teacher and coach you will be. It is the foundation for who you are and what you value in your players, and also but what you value about what you value in regards to teaching and coaching. Your philosophy helps determine whether you'll be a command or cooperative style teacher and coach. The command style of teaching and coaching uses the win first philosophy. These coaches favor extrinsic motivation. They feel responsible for directing, motivating, controlling, and persuading players, and they use rewards and or punishments as their way of dealing with their students. And punishment doesn't mean that they're going to take up their 9-iron and bonk them on the head, but they may impose additional drills and things in areas that the player may show a weakness in, as an example. Some reasons why command-style coaches coach in this manner are because they usually have low self-esteem and they've played for a similar style coach and they are low in empathy. Cooperative style teachers and coaches, on the other hand, have an athletic first philosophy. They favor intrinsic motivation and feel that motivation, potential for development, capacity for assuming responsibility, and the ability to work towards individual and team goals are present or can be developed. And that is the teachers and coaches' responsibility to help athletes develop these qualities through sport. Some reasons why cooperative style teachers and coaches operate in this manner are because they have high self-esteem. They've played for a similar style coach and they have a high empathy. And if you can, as Albert Hubbard said, if I can supply with you a thought that you may remember it or not, but if I can make you think a thought for yourself, I have indeed added to your stature. What does this mean? It basically saying that as a coach, you can tell your players what to do, command, or you will help support them to figure it out cooperative. Which coach do you want to be is what you need to ask. And at the core of your philosophy is your ability to communicate. The most important skill for teachers and coaches is the ability to communicate effectively. Communication is what separates successful teachers and coaches from the less successful teachers and coaches. Communication skills should be aligned with your philosophy and is another important element in supporting an athlete's intrinsic motivation. Effective communication is also often the difference between success and failure for the relationship between both teacher and coach and your player. What is effective communication? Well, here are some things to consider. Get to know their player as a person. Very important to do that. And when I say player, I'm not necessarily talking about a high-level player, but that you're working with. Get to know them on a personal level. Get to know some of their likes and dislikes outside of golf. Getting to know that person develops a comfort level between you and your student. Check with your student to make sure they understand what it is you're saying. In other words, explain why you may or may not be doing something. Certainly express empathy. Be sensitive to your player or student's feelings. They're obviously maybe at the beginning stages of taking lessons, and you want to be able to help them work through some of the difficult processes that they may be challenged with. Communicate consistently according to your personality and training style. Learn to be empathetic. Learn to be emphatic by putting yourself in the shoes of the athlete. So in other words, be empathic. Use a positive communication approach, which includes asking open-ended questions, encouragement, support, and positive reinforcement. So there's a lot of good things that we need to do with teachers. Good teaching and coaching is a combination of things. If you've played golf, as an example, all your life, or teaching or coaching the game probably comes pretty naturally. But the basics of being a good teacher and coach come from developing your philosophy and your ability to communicate. From there, you begin to realize the potential you have to make an impact on that player or student. Begin to understand how you can support your players more fully and help them figure out how to enhance their mental game. Every golfer has the potential for greatness, and you can help them certainly get there. So, some food for thought, for coaches and teacher professionals out there. A couple things, just let me leave, a sort of a final thought here with communication. Obviously, we need to communicate as best we can with our students. And obviously, some students we're going to communicate more effectively with than others. But we should always certainly give our best effort. I think doing things in such a way that we learn to understand ourselves first and understand what it is we want, what do we want to get out of teaching or coaching. Obviously, there's monetary factors involved, but it's not just a job. There are a lot of people that get into this business, it's because they enjoy golf and they also feel that they have a certain way of our ability to help others and enjoy doing that. And that's certainly one of the reasons why I got into the teaching end of it. Certainly I enjoy playing golf, but I also enjoy helping others to play their best golf. And I try to, I try to communicate as best I can with students. And I remember that every student is different. What might work for her. So we're going to talk about a lot of these different things in some of the upcoming coaches' corners. As I mentioned to the guys a few weeks ago, this season I wanted to kind of get my feet wet a little bit with the panel and just take some general questions and help with some of the tips. But I want to get into a little deeper, philosophy, if you will, in working with some of the people and some of the coaches and that, and really get into some of the meat and potatoes, if you will, of coaching and how we can help to improve not only our own individual coaching styles, but hopefully shed some information that will help others in the industry. So make sure that you stay tuned for that. As I said, that will be coming up, the Plan for Success series, with some great coaches, some that have been on the program, and some new ones will be coming and joining us as well. One of the other things that I wanted to talk about, I thought would be kind of interesting to share, is dealing with being under pressure. And I've got some examples here out of the archives, if you will, that I thought would be interesting to share. Some of you older folks out there like myself will probably remember some of these. Some of the younger ones may not, but I thought it was kind of interesting, and I thought I would share it with you. And really, being under pressure, of course, it happens to the best of us. And, you know, here's sort of a question here that I thought I would throw out. What do Doug Sanders, Ed Snead, Scott Hoke, and Tom Watson have in common? And as I said, if you're somebody who's obviously in my age group, you undoubtedly know all of these golfers as a gentleman that had missed a short putt that would have won him a major championship. And less kind people might have said these players choked, but and they might be or might not be right, but too many people automatically label a failure to perform in the clutch as a choke when it simply may have not been the case. We all are human, of course. A three-foot putt missed on the front nine Thursday morning of a tournament doesn't receive the same harsh assessment as one missed Sunday afternoon, certainly not by some of the armchair critics. But on the other hand, there are certainly visible signs that identify if a failure to hole a putt was a choke or not. A choke can be defined as letting the pressure of the situation directly lead to the failure to execute correctly. And we're going to examine each of these cases individually. So let's talk. The first one I want to talk about is what happened to Doug Saunders at the 1970 British Open in St. Andrews. And really, of all the final hole major meltdowns, this is probably one of, as has been put many times, is probably the granddaddy of them all. The clip that, if you ever get a chance, I'm sure you can get it on YouTube and that, but the clip of Saunders missing 3-foot putt to win the 72nd green jacket and then pathetically chasing after it are apparent, would be apparent after missing the misbehaving child is certainly legendary. Three-foot putt would have given Saunders a one-stroke victory over, of course, none other than Jack Nicklaus in his prime. Nicklaus went on to win the playoff the next day. And here's essentially what happened. After driving, really doing a great drive on the final hole of regulation, Saunders was faced with approximately 60 yards left of the pin, which was located in the middle part of the green. Saunders, of course, walked all the way up to the pin and examined the location before walking all the way back to hit the ball. He put his approach shot, past the pin, leaving himself a 40-foot putt. His putt from there stopped 3 feet short, leaving him with a left-to-right putt, which is probably one of the toughest kind for a right-hander to make, a lot of people believe. And if you watch the video of the sort of ill-fated putt, Saunders can be seen standing frozen over the ball for the longest time before finally reaching down with his left hand to pick something up in his line. He then immediately gets back into his putting stance and again freezes over for the longest time before before pulling the trigger. Most who witnessed that that particular event live knew that Saunders had no chance of making the putt. Undoubtedly, it's safe to say that the pressure did him in. And that's definitely a case, I think, where the pressure got the better of him. Now, it's Snead, on the other hand, in the 1979 Masters at Augusta. He was, of course, a journeyman and probably one of the better journeymen at that time. He had 3 PGA Tour victories to his credit, and his swing was really considered to be one of the best on tour at that time. Entering the final round of the 79 Masters, Snead held a 5-stroke lead over the rest of the field, struggled at times during the round, and halfway through his lead was down by 1. He recovered and held a 3-stroke lead with 3 holes to play. However, he bogeyed both the 15th and 17th, and on 18th he was left with a 6-foot putt to win. Of course, the putt never had a chance, and he hit it tentatively, and the ball hung on the lip, forcing him to play off with Watson and Fuzzy Zeller. And Zeller famously holed his putt on the first sudden-death playoff victory, and it was Masters history, and Snead was left to wonder what if for the rest of his life. While Snead's meltdown wasn't necessarily as obvious as Saunders, again, the gravity of the moment likely caused him to lose his only real chance at a green jacket. Scott Hoke, of course, in the 1989 Masters, who I remember watching this one here. Hoke was was really a solid tour veteran at the time, and he came into the 1989 Masters. He came with three victories on tour and was destined for many more. But it was really the major championship that he didn't win that might have been most memorable for him. Played a good final round, shooting 69 after starting the day one stroke behind the leader, Ben Crenshaw. The problem, though, was Nick Faldo had a round that day at 65, which vaulted him into a tie for the lead after regulation play. On the first hole of sudden death, which was the 10th, Hoke hit a brilliant approach to a little more than 2 feet. Faldo missed his birdie putt and was already in for par. At this point, Hoke stood over his putt to win, but pulled it left, really never touching the hole. What was remarkable is that he now had a 5-foot putt left to continue the playoff, which he made. Unfortunately for Hoke, Faldo birdied the next hole, and of course the green jacket went to Nick on hole number 11. It's easy to say that Hoke choked in the situation, but in reviewing, really the situation at the time from the Masters, one can see that Hoke looked perfectly comfortable over the ball. Ultimately, the putt was so bad, though, that it's hard to say that whether it was simply a mechanical error or whether he felt the pressure at the time. More recently, of course, Mr. Tom Watson in 2009 at the Open Championship in Turnberry could have really gone down as perhaps one of the greatest achievements in sports history. 59-year-old Tom Watson was the story at the 2009 British Open, leading or certainly near the lead for most of the tournament. In his younger days, Watson was known for being one of the best putters of all time, and at Turnberry, Watson was putting like the Watson of old. Coming into the 72nd hole, Watson had a stroke, lead over Stuart Sink, who had already finished par would have won the championship. Watson, of course, hit a great drive, splitting the fairway in true Watson style, and, of course, leaving him with an 8-iron approach on the par 4. Made great contact with the ball and was dead on line. However, one of the cruelest breaks in major championship history occurred. The ball landed just on the green, about 50 feet short of the pin. It was a great shot, except for one thing. The ball landed on a part of the green that was very firm and sloped away from Watson. Had the ball landed 2 yards further or shorter or 2 yards left or right, he likely would have been left with within two putts inside 30 feet to win. What, of course, happened was the ball catapulted over the green into a tricky lie, and Watson putted the ball from off the green approximately 8 feet past the hole. His putt to win was nothing more than wishful thinking, and it was left short and right. And as an exhausted Watson had nothing left for the playoff, Sink ended up winning in that fashion. He certainly played great for, I'm referring to Watson, of course, played great for 71 of the holes. And 3 strokes. The only time really the situation affected him was on the 8-footer, really to win. So, again, really hard to say somebody with Watson's experience and stature whether or not he necessarily choked or it was just a victim of circumstance. But you know, one of the things that happens to all of us, regardless of whether you're playing in an open championship like Tom Watson. Or Augusta National, like Ed Snead did, and Doug Saunders, and of course Scott Hoker, or some of the more modern players. You might be just playing in your club championship, or you might be playing in a corporate event. We all feel pressure. Certainly, we or our students, as coaches, might think that we are the only ones in the world to let pressure get to us, and of course. As we've seen in these cases, that is not so. Even the best hardened competitors certainly let pressure get to them in various times. Pressure tends to affect golfers in similar ways. If we recognize what's going on, we can take steps to overcome it, even during times of high anxiety. On full shots, adrenaline tends to kick in, and of course, players tend to hit the ball too far. At St. Andrews, Saunders hit his approach shot well past the pin. Later in an interview, he said that he wanted to safely avoid the Valley of Sin, as he called it, the depression that sits in front of the 18th green, but that day the whole location wasn't anywhere near it. So if we feel an adrenaline rush and we have to make at least a half swing we would almost always hit the ball further than we intend. On a full swing, the best thing to do is to take one less club. On a half shots like Saunders' approach, we need to trust that we will likely hit the ball too far and dial back the force we intend to use, especially in a pressure situation like that. On short shots and especially putts, the tendencies are to leave the club face open, to not hit the ball hard enough, are some of the things that happen quite often. With the exception of Hoke, all of the above examples certainly bore this out. If we feel pressure while putting, we must make certain to stroke through the ball and to release the club head so we don't certainly leave it open. This instruction for tension in the full swing and short shots are not foolproof, as tension has a remarkable way of overcoming good golf. But, you know, this just goes to really show you that, you know, even the best players on the PGA Tour or LPGA, whatever tour you may be following, certainly feel pressure, as we all do. And, you know, probably one of the best ways that we can deal with pressure is not just practicing on the practice tee and up at the range, but working on the, as I talked about earlier, on the mental side of things. Your mental game, as Nicklaus has mentioned many, many times in his career, probably really represents about 90% of most people's golf game. Certainly 10% for the physical side. I mean, most people, I think, with some reasonable skill can hit the ball a decent way and certainly keep it in play. But once your mental capacity starts to diminish and starts to fall by the wayside, then all the sort of golf demons start to pounce upon you. And more often than not, you're going to start struggling in your round. So working on the mental game, pardon me, is probably one of the best things that you can do. Excuse me while I take a sip of water here. Working on your mental game, as I said, is one of the best things that you can do. And getting together with a mental coach or somebody that you're working with right now, if they are able to help you with that end of it as well. And if they're not, then you want to seek somebody out. And some of you might say, well, you know, I just play on the weekends once in a while. What do I need a mental coach for? You may not necessarily need a mental coach in that particular case, but it wouldn't hurt to, you know, talk to your professional if you're working with somebody and just explain, you know, be honest with them. Explain some of the anxieties that you feel and have out in the course. Do your own assessment. You know, jot some of the things down, make some mental notes, you know, in addition to following what it is that you do on the golf course, as far as how many putts you've made or how many greens and regulations. It's also, you know, might be worth taking some notes after the round. I don't suggest that you do too much during the round because obviously we're trying to avoid slow play, but maybe after the round you can maybe jot down some mental notes. When you're sitting in the clubhouse and maybe having a sandwich or a drink, and don't just replay the shots, but replay some of the anxieties. You know, think about some of the things that, you know, affected your play. You know, for instance, you might have been on the 10th tee, and maybe it was a daunting par 5, and you just felt you weren't going to be able to reach it in 2, and were unsure of whether to try and lay up with your second shot or whether you should try and go for it. You might be faced with a situation where you're hitting over water. That might be something that creates a lot of anxiety. If that's the case, then you want to make note of that and say, okay, these are areas that I feel my highest stress levels in my golf. And those are things that you might want to bring up the next time you are working with your coach or teacher and say, these are areas of my game. You know, everybody always focuses on the simple things. And let me give you some examples. I always get, when I have students, I work with a lot of corporate clients. And, of course, a big thing for them is they want to look good for their corporate events. So I try to guide them as best I can. And one of the things that I always say to them, okay, is, well, what is it you want to get out of your golf game? And obviously they want to score better and they want to play better. But more often than not, they just want to look better. They just want to, you know, play a respectable round of golf, and great if they win the tournament, but that's not really the most important thing. For them, it's just they want to look good in front of their colleagues or peers, and they just want to you know, to have some fun. So the first thing that I always say to them is, number one, you have to have fun. If you're not out enjoying what it is that you're doing, I don't care what it is, but in this case, we're, you know, of course, we're talking golf, you have to have fun and enjoy it. And if you're not doing that, then you need to ask yourself why. And if it's because your head is so filled with so many thoughts of, well, you know, I've got to keep this straight and I've got to do that, or swing thoughts, or, you know, hopped up with anxiety of playing certain holes and things like that, then you're not going to have a stress-free and enjoyable round. You're going to have some stress, I don't care what level of player, but how you handle that stress is going to dictate how well you're going to play your game. Most high handicappers that I've seen, with obviously few exceptions, can hit a decent ball. They may not be able to hit it 300 yards down the middle, but they might be able to hit it 200 yards and keep it in play, or certainly hit a respectable shot. That being the case, develop a go-to shot. If you typically fade the ball, you know, 5 or 10 yards, if that's your shot, or draw the ball, whichever the case may be, and I'm of course referring to right-handed golfers here, then you want to have that shot in your bag, and you want to refer to that anytime that you're in a stressful situation. If you know that you can hit that shot at least 50% of the time that shot is going to be successful, then that's the shot that you want to go to. And the reason why I say that is, sometimes you might be faced with a situation that maybe, as I said, you might be hitting over water to the green. There might be a pond or a small lake in front of the green or part of the front, and the pin may be cut in such a way that you're going to have to carry some water. Maybe what you might want to consider doing is aiming a little bit left or towards the left side of the green, or even a little bit left of the green, and fade the ball back in. So in other words, aim, if depending on the shape of the hole, maybe the hole is such where the water doesn't cover completely in front of the green, aim a little bit left of the trouble. And, you know, still keeping your target in mind, but aim a little bit left of your target and allow that natural fade that you've been able to play work for you. So that way you're hitting a shot that you're comfortable with, and that's going to help you reduce the anxiety. Don't try, you know, one of the worst things that I've seen working with a lot of amateurs is they will try shots that they've seen, you know, Tiger or Phil you know, Stuart Sink or some of these other tour players, Freddie Couples comes to mind. You know, these are certainly very high caliber players. They have certain abilities. They're able to execute shots that most players can't execute without tons of practice and coaching and a lot of work on their game. So even they will, of course, struggle from time to time, but they have a certain comfort level knowing what shots they can play and when they can draw on those shots. So if you're not somebody at that level, you need to be realistic. And one of the ways that you can do that is have a go-to shot, number one. Make some mental notes, as I was suggesting here a moment ago, of some of the anxieties that you might be feeling when you're out on the course. And make a note and then review them. Review what holes caused you, especially if you're playing a course that you play, maybe you belong or you're a member somewhere and you're playing or playing a public course on a regular basis, you know the course quite well. Make a note of all the holes that give you the highest anxiety. It might be long par fives. It might be a difficult par four. Maybe it's even a par three. Make a note of those holes. Break them down and say, okay, what is it about this hole that causes me the most anxiety? Is it hitting over water? Is it because the green's surrounded by bunkers and I'm not a good sand player? Is it just it's an awfully long hole? I'm not a very big hitter, so it's difficult for me to reach it in regulation, and I feel that a lot of times it taps me out, you know, of my abilities. So once you establish that, then you can go back and you can examine each hole and say, okay, how can I play this hole differently that will reduce the amount of anxiety? As I mentioned here, let's say you have a par five that might be 540 yards, let's say. And you only hit the ball maybe 230 yards. Well, that's going to leave you with 310 yards. Well, even some of the top tour players are not going to try and go for it. So obviously what you want to do in a case like this is be realistic and say, okay, what number do I need to hit to get to that comfortable layup position that I could hit a good wedge shot or even a short iron, you know, a 9-iron, let's say, preferably I want to hit my wedge, but let's say even a 9-iron to the green. So I want to work from the green back, and I want to say, okay, I can hit my drive, I know, roughly 225, 230 yards. That's going to leave me 310 yards left. I want to get to 100 yards. So, you know, I want to hit a club that's going to hit maybe about 200 yards. Or maybe I might even want to hit 185 and leave me a little bit more than 100 yards left to the pin, where I'm hitting a shot that's going to be more comfortable. So there's a lot of variables that you can look at, but that's what you need to do is break them down. And what I would suggest is these are things, once you've made your notes and once you've sort of analyzed what it is that you have high anxiety about, then maybe what you want to do is then you want to go to your teacher or coach and you want to discuss this. Set up a time with them during one of your lessons and say, okay, instead of us working on the range, I'd like to sit and maybe have a coffee or something and talk about some of the anxieties that I feel when I'm out playing a round of golf, and especially when you're getting in preparation for you know, an upcoming event, whether it be a corporate event or maybe you're playing in a club championship. So these are some things that you can do to help as I said, you know, under pressure, it happens to all of us. Even some of the most elite players feel pressure from time to time, so it's nothing to be ashamed of. But what you do need to do is you need to be truthful to yourself and honest with yourself and do an assessment and then discuss it. And if you're not working with a teacher professional in your area, then I would certainly recommend that you seek one out if you want to improve. Even if you're just playing, you know, every weekend or every other weekend, you know, working with a teacher professional who has certain skills and abilities to help make you a better golfer and help explain some of the things that you're going to be dealing with out there will help you to enjoy the game that much more. And when you enjoy it, then you're going to have fun. And the more fun that you have, the more apt you are to want to go out and play again. I think one of the biggest things that's happening out there right now in golf and has for a few years, and I'm being completely honest here, is I think that a lot of people are just not having fun anymore. It's become very complicated at times. Golf is certainly not an easy game. It has a unique set of challenges, unlike many other sports. But it also has some great rewards that are equal to, in fact, even greater than some of the daunting tasks. But, you know, you have to be smart when you're out seeking a teacher professional or coach. And don't be afraid, as we've said many times before, you know, interview two or three. If you're not working with somebody now, you know, depending on where you are, if you're in a large city or somewhere where there's many, many courses around, you know, go to some of the different courses, call them up and talk to their pro or go and meet with them and sit down and, you know, when they've got some time and just talk to them and just say, you know, I'm interested in taking some lessons and kind of get a feel for them, see what they're about and see how you interact with them. Get to know them a little bit as well. It's not just about us getting to know you as teacher professionals, getting to know their students, but the students need to get to know their teacher professionals. What are they like? What don't they like? You know, how do they handle pressure? When they're faced with a pressure situation, what do they do? What are some of the common, you know, things that they do to help themselves through? And you'll find that everybody's the same. We all feel pressure and stress at times. But how you handle them is what the difference in making you a better player. And many of the coaches out there have been very well taught, not just in how to play the game of golf and how to hit the ball well, but many nowadays have gone further yet and taken some courses on, as I said earlier, the mental side of the game and how to handle these different situations and stress. And that's why you're seeing so many sports psychologists and things like that in the field, much like my guest coming up here shortly, Dr. Molinaro. And, you know, one of the things that we're going to talk about is how he helps some of his athletes and students, how he helps them handle the pressure. So when he comes out here in just a few moments, we'll talk to Dr. Nick and we'll ask him some of those questions. But those are some things that you know, we all need to work on. We all need to, you know, to become a better player. And it doesn't really take a lot of time. And also it's going to help you in other areas of your life, not just in your golf game. If you can handle stress in other areas of your life, it'll help and transcend out to your golf game. Excuse me one moment. It's a little dry in here tonight, so my throat, you'll forgive me if I take a drink or two of water here and there. But, you know, the mental side of the game is really something that I think a lot of people, especially high handicappers, take for granted. I don't think they truly understand how important that is and, you know, why they need to really focus on that. And I think that, as I said, working together with some great teaching pros out there who are well-trained not only in the ball-striking ability but also in the mental side of the game is something that you definitely want to do is connect with them and get them to help you work through those areas. Let me just remind everybody, of course, we are live on Golf Talk Live tonight. Every Thursday evening at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. You can tune into the program on blogtalkradio.com, and you can just go to the link there. It's www.blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive, or you can just type in Golf Talk Live up in the search key. You can certainly speak either to myself or any of the guests that are on the show. You can call into the program on area code 646-716-4667 anytime during the live broadcast, which is Thursday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. Central Time. That's 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also get email questions or comments to me if you want personally about the show at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com. And if you're a teacher professional or somebody in the golf industry and you've been tuning into the program, or maybe you have an associate who's been on the program and maybe you feel you have something to add to the mix, by all means, feel free to throw your hat in the ring, and you can contact me through my email at ted.golftalklive@gmail.com, and I will certainly get back with you and set something up. Also get updates through social media by going to Facebook and liking the program. You can go to facebook.com/golftalkliveblog. Make sure you have blog on the end there. And I certainly appreciate all of those that have gone and liked the page. It's growing in numbers, and I appreciate that. And make sure that you pass this around. You know, one of the ways that this program has really gained a lot of momentum over this last year, as most of you know that follow the program, I do promote it through various social media, but I don't do a lot of great advertising. And what I mean by that is I don't, you know, I'm not splashed all over billboards or things like that. And the reason I do that is, you know, obviously it's cost effective for one. But, you know, I really am a firm believer in sort of a grassroots movement. And the show has really done extremely well. In fact, I couldn't be happier with the results. We have a very large global audience that tunes into the program every week. And, literally from virtually every corner of this planet tuning into the broadcast, and the numbers are growing each and every week and every month. So thank you for that. But what I would certainly ask is that you pass it on and let others know to tune into the program. We've got some great guests, and if you've missed any of the live broadcast, not to worry, there is an on-demand section, much like your cable provider has. There is an on-demand section. You go to the link that I just mentioned. I'll give it again at the end of the program at blogtalkradio.com. And when you click in Golf Talk Live, during the live broadcast, of course, the current programming live broadcast will be front and center, but you can scroll down afterwards and you can see the previously recorded episodes, and you can tune into one of your favorites if you've got one there. and you can listen to them, pass them around, share them, and say, hey, I was tuning into the program last week. They had some great tips in the Coach's Corner panel. Thought you might like to hear this. So you can email the links to your partners in golf and help grow this audience. And I appreciate all of you for tuning in. As I said, the audience has been growing every week since I started this last year. And so much so that I actually created a second show called The Women of Golf. And, of course, that's every Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's, of course, I'm joined by none other than one of the hardest working women in golf, LPGA professional Cindy Miller, who is not only a great teacher professional, but she is also a player on the Legends Tour, which is the equivalent of the Champions Tour for ladies, and doing some great things out there. So Cindy and I are talking golf for the ladies every Tuesday morning here on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and that's Women of Golf. So you can get there the same way. You can type in blogtalkradio.com/ Women of Golf, and that will take you to that program. And as well, that's Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and it runs for 1 hour till 10. And Cindy and I are on there every Tuesday, and we're working as hard as we can to help grow this game in an area that is really under-tapped. Certainly there are a lot of millions of golfers out there, but in comparison, it's certainly still a male-dominant sport. But the ladies are joining in now and taking it up a notch, as Emerald was Emerald Lagosse said, they are starting to get more involved. A lot of great female teacher professionals and a lot of players out there are really pushing to help grow this game. And as I understand, last week, this past Tuesday, we had Karen Palacios Jansen on the program, who is a very prominent lady teacher professional with the LPGA, and she talked about a new certification program that the LPGA has put out called Teaching Her, and it's really designed to help teach professionals such as myself and others out the business work with women golfers out there, how to teach and work with them a little bit differently. And some might say, well, what's the difference? Well, men and women do learn differently, as we've discovered over the years. And we listen differently, we speak differently, and we communicate differently. So it only makes sense that if you're going to do some things one way for men and some things one way for women in most everyday life, it only seems natural that golf needs to do that as well. So that is available. If you go to lpga.com, I believe she said, Karen said that there is a link there that talks about that. So a lot of great things happening, and we're trying to do our part, Cindy and I, with the Women of Golf every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. So please join us. We appreciate the support, and we're trying to grow that audience as well. And so for any of you ladies that are tuning into the Golf Talk Live program, certainly want you to tune in every week and listen to this program. But if you want something that's geared a little bit more for the ladies, then you might want to tune into the Tuesday morning show. And if you can't tune in live, certainly we would love to have you join us live. But if you can't, as I said, the programs are all auto-recorded during these live broadcasts. So for those of you that may have other things going on in your busy schedules, you can certainly pick up and listen to the programs when it's convenient for you. So as long as you're tuning in, I'm okay with that, and I appreciate you tuning in tonight. A quick sip of water here, excuse me, and we should, in a few moments here, be joined by my guest this evening, Dr. Nick Molinaro, and shortly after that, Brian Dobby will be joining us, and Chris Trunzer will also be joining us as well a little bit later on in the broadcast. These are two individuals who have worked with Dr. Nick, and he's going to let them talk a little bit about their experiences and also get to hear a little bit about, well, some of what I talked about earlier about the mental side of things and how he's helping athletes out there in all areas, not just golf, but obviously we're going to talk a little bit golf tonight, how he's helping them through his sports psychology. And So as we wait for Nick to come on board here, and it looks like he's here, so let me just give you a quick rundown. As I said, my guest tonight, of course, is Dr. Nick Molinaro, and he is a licensed psychologist. He's a sports psychologist and is the co-founder of Vantage Sports Psychology Group. He's a licensed psychologist and has been working with athletes, business executives, and performing artists for over 20 years now. Dr. Molinaro earned his bachelor's degree in psychology from the University of Scranton, earned a master's from Keene College of New Jersey, and his doctoral degree in human development from Fairleigh Dickinson University, received a postgraduate education and training at the College of William & Mary, Temple University, and San Diego University for integrative studies, excuse me. He's a member of the Association for Applied Sports Psychology, New Jersey Psychological Association, and the American Psychological Association, and divisions of sports psychology and counseling psychology. So without further hesitation, would you welcome my guest this evening? Welcome, Dr. Nick Molinaro, to Golf Talk Live.
Thank you, Ted, and I appreciate the invitation to be on your esteemed show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to have you on here, and we were actually talking, or I was talking a little bit earlier. I don't know if you managed to catch any of the earlier part of the show, but was really sort of talking about the mental game a little bit, and how, you know, people really need to spend a lot of time on that area of the game, and really much more so than the physical side of it. So we're going to talk a little bit about that tonight. And a little bit later, in actually a few moments, we'll be joined by PGA teacher professional Brian Dobby, who's been on the program before. And actually, that's how Nick and I came about connecting. So thank you, Brian. I'll thank you, of course, when you go on the show, but I appreciate making the connection. Nick, let's just talk a little bit about, first off, how the Vantage Sports Psychology Group came together, how you guys, and actually you have a partner in there, Chris Michaels, Dr. Michaels, as well as yourself headed this up. Tell us a little bit about that and some of the things that you're doing with it.
Well, Chris and I have been colleagues for a long period of time, and both of us have been working in sports psychology and decided to bring our practices together. And the reason for that was that we were offered the opportunity to work with Diamond Nation, which is a baseball program or in the area, and several other baseball programs, Randolph Batting Instruction, RBIs. And then as the practice grew and both of our interests grew in golf, we also consult with the David Glenn's Golf Academy, and currently I'm over at Fiddler's Elbow, which is they have a golf academy that I'm also the consulting sports psychologist with. So we needed to be able to bring our practices together to offer a program that was diverse enough and had enough personnel to meet the needs. We also consult with Madison Medical and Sports Rehabilitation Center, Inception Sports Performance over in Madison, New Jersey. So we've been fortunate enough to continue to develop our practice and be consulting sports psychologists to several groups.
Let me just ask you an obvious question I think that most people would probably want to know is, you know, in this day and age, obviously, we've got a lot of top athletes in a variety of sports, but obviously here in golf, such as, you know, Tigers comes to mind. Why is it important that, especially this level of player, that they have a sports psychologist in their bag?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, I think if you take a look at how many professionals on the PGA Tour are seeing sports psychologists, the statistics indicate that there's more tour players seeing sports psychologists than swing coaches. And if you take a look at the rigor of the sport and golf in comparison to some other sports, because it's a closed sport, which means that, you know, you are the one who's kind of proactive in getting things started versus soccer, obviously the World Cup, or basketball. So everything initiates with the player, and everything that begins in play actually begins with your brain. And the fact that the mind controls the brain, and the brain controls the body controls the club head, how you spend your time within yourself, your mind, is so important. So as you know, a golf swing is 1.3 to 1.5 seconds to shoot. Yep. Are you're only spending 90 seconds in a 4.5 round golf actually swinging a club. What do you do with the rest of the time? Well, the rest of the time, if it's not social, we're talking about competition, you have to keep your mind so alert to bring yourself into what we come close to as the zone of performing optimally and bring yourself out of that so that you don't wear yourself out mentally. There's no other sport that requires this kind of in and out for such a brief period of time to execute such a finite skill. So that's
right.
The reason I think that it's necessary to have people like myself with professionals.
Now, obviously, you know, taking it to a different area with some of the amateur golfers out there, obviously they're not necessarily in a position or maybe necessarily have a need to have an ongoing relationship with a sports psychologist. But how could they benefit from, let's say, working with somebody such as yourself? Obviously there's personal benefits, but what are some of the benefits and how is it going to help their game? I mean, obviously we know how it's going to help the elite athlete such as Tiger Woods or Phil Mickelson or some of the other top guys on the tour. But how could working with somebody such as yourself, how is it going to help, you know, Joe Smith, who's maybe just playing in some corporate events, a few corporate events a year, and maybe plays every weekend with his buddies. How can you help somebody like him?
Well, let's take a look at actually what, you know, this whole performance program is about. We're not only working with what's happening on the course, we're working with what's happening off the course. So every moment of
right.
every day you're making decisions, and those decisions are either conscious or subconscious. And how you make those decisions is really based upon where you place your attention. So are you placing your attention in the right place? So let's take a look at a student. Is he placing his attention in the right place for his studies? Is he placing his attention in the right place to manage emotions? Both of those qualities are the things that you use on the golf course as well as you use in everyday life. And there's a high correlation between performance in sport and performance in business. Actually, the studies have shown that factors that elite athletes use are great examples demonstrated in performances in business. So when I work with, a junior, I'm not only working with them in terms of the performance on the course, it's also about the performance in life, managing emotions, directing attention, decision-making, screening out distractions, and, you know, confidence issues. So it's really a global process. So a lot of the juniors I'll see for just several sessions to debrief them on a test that I do, teach them some basic mental skills on the course, off the course, and then try to help them apply that in other parts of their life.
Now, Nick, how do you, let's say as an example, and this can obviously happen at any level, but we'll deal with it with the athletes just to simplify the process. Obviously, because you're working with them and dealing with issues that are happening outside of the golf arena, shall we say, obviously you maybe have a new player that you're working with and they come to you with a situation where they've got a lot of external baggage they're carrying, they've got a lot of things going on off the course, and it's very apparent and it's showing up in their play. How do you sort of address that with them and how do you sort of help them to keep things in focus and sort of remove some of these distractions while they're playing? How do you work through that process with them?
Well, first of all, we try to make what's called a kind of a differential diagnosis. So when we look at our work, you know, in sport and performance psychology, we're teaching them how to do those kinds of performances in the sport, on the field. When we get to issues that might be influencing them off the course, then sometimes those individuals might need therapy. And that becomes a different
right.
process, and that can be done with with another professional. So we try to differentiate between the attention that we're helping them with in terms of their performance and other issues that might be off the course. Now, stress is a very significant factor, and so a lot of players will also be seeing someone to help them manage, you know, whether it's a marital issue or, you know, a anxiety or depression. I have athletes that have conditions that are like that, or even attention deficit disorders. Some players have to be on medication for any of those conditions. So that's the way we do. We try to differentially diagnose where our attention is in terms of performance, and then other issues that might be separate from that, that might be a clinical basis to them.
Exactly, and well said. Now, you obviously do some work. You've worked with not just those playing golf, but you also work with some of those in the teaching end of it, maybe to help them become better coaches and teachers. And one gentleman I can think of is, of course, Mr. Brian Dobby. So why don't we bring Brian on? I see he's here in the queue, and
great,
we'll bring him on, and we'll talk to him as well.
Great.
Good evening, Brian, and welcome to Golf Talk Live.
Hey, Ted, how you doing? Thanks for having me back.
Not too bad. Of course, those of you maybe just tuning into the program, of course, joining Dr. Nick Molinaro and myself this evening is none other than PGA teacher professional Mr. Brian Dobby, who's been on the show a few times as a guest and also on the Coach's Corner panel. So, Brian, thank you for coming on. And we were just talking a little bit. We just sort of got into the conversation here, Nick and I, and one of the questions I was just about to ask him, we talked about how he is helping some of the players, but how has he helped you? And explain a little bit your relationship with Nick.
Sure, Ted. Well, first off, Doc, how are you? Thanks for being on the show, and thanks for having me as a guest. Thank you, Doc. I met Dr. Nick about 5 years ago now, Doc, I guess, and we hit it off, and Doc offered to show me what he was doing, and I got very interested because at the time I was struggling with my game a little bit, and I've always been intrigued and curious about the mental side, so we sat down, and Dr. Nick ran me through his diagnostic testing, and we found a couple areas that I needed some work in, and we addressed those, and he gave me some great tips and programs how to address those, and I started working on that, and gradually each year I started to perform better under pressure, and last year I really had a fine year, and I owe it all to him because before I met Doc, it just wasn't clicking for me.
Brian,
you're selling yourself short there, Brian. The benefits that you get from me are because of the kind of hard work that you put into it. So, you know, it's easier for me to do the teaching, and it's always really dependent upon the players, you know, taking it. And you've obviously been a great student.
Now,
well,
Brian, let me ask you a question. You know, obviously, the physical benefits of being able to play better are one, but how has what you've learned from Dr. Nick helped you in your teaching side as well? How have you been able to sort of move that and gravitate it into your teaching as well?
Well, I've used some of his techniques with some of my students, trying to get an idea of how they're thinking or what they're thinking about on the course and trying to find situations that they might be uncomfortable with, hitting certain shots or playing in tournaments or whatever. And I've tried to apply some of the same techniques to their routines, and it works. You know, if we can target one area and get somebody to focus a little bit better or imagine a shot a little bit better instead of thinking about water or out of bounds or whatever, it's going to help in the long run, and it's helped. So I try to just interview my students a little bit and try to find where they might be struggling and try to address those needs.
Right. Do you think, and this is really for both of you, and Nick, I'll let you go first. You know, I mentioned a few moments ago about a lot of outside distractions that a player may be faced with, and you very eloquently explained some of the process of breaking it down. But when you've got a situation where it's very evident that there are outside elements affecting somebody's game, and we won't get into too many specifics because there could be a myriad of situations, what are things, once you've sort of diagnosed and found out what the problems are, how do you then get the students to sort of say, okay, we're going to deal with X, Y, and Z over here, but we're going to be able to do this over here to help you go out and play better and work with these separately? How do you separate the two, in other words?
That's an excellent question. Well, the The methodology that both myself and my partner, Dr. Chris Michaels, use is a system that helps players differentiate between internal and external distractions and training them how to attend in the moment. And again, it's for brief periods of time. Certainly stress accumulates and can influence performance, but when you look at high-level performers, and the test that we give, by the way, is also given to the Navy SEALs, as well as it's given to professional and junior athletes, as well as Fortune 500 CEOs.
Right.
Pressure. The performer, athlete, a performing artist, businessman, junior, use a system that is the most effective by training how to shift your attention from external cues initially to an internal cue of making a decision, let's say what club you're going to use or how you're going to take the club back, you know, for the shape of shot or putt. To shift that attention, that's where we spend most of our time. Now, at any moment in time, you can actually teach your brain by using your mind to redirect their attention. And that's how we do this. So when I was talking about kind of parceling off whether it's a clinical issue and just
right.
kind of leaving that over here, we can train athletes and business people, juniors, to redirect their attention. And that's basically what our focus is. We try to teach them how to make that attention shift.
Brian, let me ask you, just a little bit different way of putting this. You obviously have students that maybe you're working with and trying to get them to focus, to be in the moment during a round. You know, for instance, they're standing over a shot. You're preparing them how to mentally get ready for that shot. But do you also then prepare them when they're out of that element to think differently? In other words, you can't always for 18 holes, for 4 or 5 hours, constantly be so focused on the shots that you, in layman's term, forget to smell the flowers. So you have to sort of be able to get yourself in and out of the zone. How do you help your students with that?
Well, I think trying to get them into the process of the shot is where it begins. And, most amateurs play golf in the future and the past. And Dr. Nick really helped me with this, trying to get into the moment, get into your pre-shot routine and just hit the shot. So for that 20 seconds, that's all you need to focus on. Execute the shot, and then if it doesn't come out the way you wanted it, do a little post-shot routine, trying to imagine the shot again in a positive way, and then just let it go, and then talk about something else, change the subject, and then get down to your next shot, and then restart your pre-shot routine. So basically, what Dr. Nick helped me with the most was letting go of the round a little bit and to save energy mentally. So as the round progressed, I would actually gain energy because I was not burning myself out, trying to focus for 4 hours because you can't do that. So
with
our students, it's just, for 10, 20 seconds, get into the shot, hit it, and then let it go, and then just do that again.
Right.
And the way that gets done, Ted,
go ahead.
And the way that gets done, and Brian addressed briefly the pre-shot routine. The pre-shot routine is diagnostic, that it tells us when the player is ready to hit. So when we talk about these distractions that are external or internal, if the player follows the pre-shot that we develop, we know that when they're over the ball, their attention is what's called externally focused, that there's one very specific thing that they have to focus on. And so I'll use different techniques depending upon the player. Notice is when you're ready to hit. So a player who is a scratch golfer or pro, they need a pre-shot for every routine. Well, they need a pre-shot for every routine because they can't tell which of the 3 to 5 shots around that they're going to have difficulty with. They carry themselves with them through every shot. So how do you know when you're ready? And that's what the pre-shot does. It diagnoses when you're ready to pull the trigger.
And, one of the biggest problems that I see with most players, and again, I'm sort of going back to the amateur players now. I mean, the professionals are on a different level, but a lot of the amateur players, and this is really what I was getting to, they seem to have a problem of knowing when to focus and when not to focus. In other words, they get once the gates open and they're out there playing, they're so focused on what they're doing that more often than not they're doing themselves more harm than good. So what are some suggestions for, say, some of our high handicappers out there that might be tuning in tonight that they can do in order to, enjoy the round a little bit more, but be focused and attentive when they need to during the round? So is there obviously pre-shot routine is a good thing, but what are some things that you make suggestions for them during their round to help them maybe not be too serious all the time? What are some things that you help to do with that? Nick, I'll let you go first.
Okay, so let's say the shot is completed, and you know whether it's a good shot or not is less the issue. And one of the things we have to do is teach individuals to manage their emotions and their attention when they're not swinging the club. So I think that's really what you're asking. So one way
sure.
to do this is to make sure that your body is relaxed. And so simply put, being in the moment, kind of protect fairway, feel your feet, get a sense of the heaviness of your feet, get a sense mm-hmm. of as you go from the rough into the fairway onto the green, get a sense of awareness of that. And I use this technique, which I describe as kind of erasing an emotional reaction. So kind of look at something off into the distance. You can look at the flag. And without moving your eyes, try to become aware of what's to the right of the pin and what's to the left of the pin. Now, as you're doing that and you're focused on that, you're kind of erasing the left side of the brain where there's a lot of thoughts, and you're bringing yourself into the moment of what you're paying attention to. You do the same thing looking at a tree or some other aspect of the environment. And what this does is bring you into the moment and takes you away from any of those other thoughts. We give a very specific breathing technique, which is also helpful in getting the mind and body to work in unison. So those are some simple examples of how we try to bring a player out of the attention that's necessary to perform the task and clear their mind, at least for another.
And Brian, let me ask you, separate from the teaching aspect, obviously we know we're talking about the playing. Brian, what are some things that you've done as a result of working with Dr. Nick that have helped you to make more effective decisions on the course? What are some things that you're doing?
Well, Dr. Nick and I worked on with my program to, actually start to slow down myself as I would get to my ball and it was my turn to hit. So I would find myself actually speeding up under stressful situations. So we practiced slowing down, focusing on my breathing, and kind of putting myself into slow motion. And I found that very effective. So it would give me a chance to get back into the moment, focus on my breathing, which is a very present specific thing right there if you focus on your breath. And then it would slow down my whole routine, and then I'd have a chance to just visualize my shot, get into my routine, and then pull the trigger and go. So that was one technique that worked tremendous for me. As Dr. Nick was talking about, there's certain shots during the round that are more stressful than others, and I learned to recognize
right.
that, and that's when I would actually, all right, start walking slower. There's no hurry here. Get into your routine and just bringing myself back into a comfortable state to execute my shot.
Right. Now, Nick, how do you – one of the things that I wanted to ask you, and we'll use Brian here as our guinea pig, how did you sort of balance out everybody sort of has their own natural rhythm, and I'll give you an example looking at some of the players, say comparable to Freddie Couples compared to a Nick Price. Nick was a very quick player, very quick in his actions. Freddie is a very slow, methodical. How do you, without changing somebody's natural rhythm, how are you able to accomplish what it is that you did with Brian without changing their whole makeup?
That's great. Question. All right, so what we found out, and Brian, I actually have your scores up here so I can refer to them a really critical way. Brian had a tendency that under pressure that he would speed up his decision making. So it's not necessarily even walking down the course. We're playing quickly. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at is the rhythm of decision making and making it very consistent. Under pressure, what Brian would do is that he would move to the ball before he actually made the most effective decision. And Brian's got very, very good awareness. One of the things that has really helped him, he's got very good awareness, and he's very flexible cognitively, which means that he can actually shift his attention, you know, in a world-class way. We have ways of comparing his scores to certain athlete groups. And so we would put Brian in a world-class category of being able to shift his attention effectively. Now, under pressure, he would shift his attention prematurely, would shift his attention to swinging the club before he actually made the decision. And so we had to slow that whole process down by getting him to become aware of his body. And basically, the first step that he makes into moving into the shot, we can tell whether or not his rhythm is off there. So I'll videotape players and show them how they move to the ball. So we increase his awareness, getting him to slow his decision-making down. And one thing we use here is like opposite thinking. Oh, should is it driver or is it three wood? Do I play aggressively? Do I play conservatively? So we use kind of opposite thinking as one way to do that. The other thing is to train them by becoming aware of how they're actually moving the body and whether or not station all fits together. So on the videotape, we can actually see whether or not they're moving too quickly. So that's one way we got them to actually see it and then feel it.
Very interesting. Just to add into the mix, if we, I see that Chris is here as well, so let's bring Chris on. Chris, of course, plays on the mini tour. We're going to get to talk to him in just a minute here. Chris, welcome to Golf Talk Live.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
We're glad to have you join us here. Of course, Dr. Nick Molinaro, you know very well. And, of course, Brian Dobby, a teacher professional from New Jersey, is joining us as well. So, Chris, tell us a little bit about yourself, first off, and how you came about working with Nick.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm born and raised in Germany. I've been in the States for about 7 years now, about, I would say, for 3 years total now, full-time living in Orlando, and trying to make it on the PGA Tour. Nick and I met about exactly a year ago. I was in the process of applying or talking to a Team Align, which is a sports marketing company that supports golfers. And Nick actually screened my personality and my mental skills in order to make sure that Team Align is only employing good golfers that have a chance making it on the tour and also staying on the tour. And that's how we met. We started with some Skype sessions, some mental tests, personality tests, and then we met in person exactly a year ago in New Jersey.
Yeah. Fantastic. Nick, let me ask you. With respect to Chris. Now, here's obviously this is a perfect example. Here's somebody that obviously has great aspirations to make it out on the bigger tours. What are some things that you're working with him that you can talk about, and areas that you really want to make sure that he's going to play his best when he gets out on the PGA Tour?
Well, clearly, what we look at. You know, in the assessment phase of this is how effectively he uses his awareness. And awareness is both external, what's going on the course, and internally, how he's actually feeling. So we train him. We first assess it, and then we train him. We then take a look at the factors that distract him. So in an example, and not using Chris, not Chris specifically, but an example of looking at the distractions. So let's say someone is distracted by wind coming left to right, out of bounds left, and dog leg left. That specific shot will cause some players to tense up and hook the ball. So part of what we do with Chris then is look at some of the factors that may influence his performance by what are the significant distractors in his game, externally and internally. And then as we identify them, then we actually train him how to use it very effectively. And Chris, by the way, is not very externally distracted. He has a very good reign over things that are going on during his performance, so he doesn't get distracted by scores very much like a lot of other players do.
Right.
We also work with him on how to shift his attention appropriately and to look at his what's called cognitive flexibility. And Chris has great cognitive flexibility, and I would, again, put that in the kind of a world-class way. And we also look at how he manages emotions. So those would be some of the things that we pay attention to.
Now, Chris, obviously every player has areas of their game, you know, that they want to work on and improve on. The physical game, obviously, to play at the level that you do, I think you're obviously have most of, I mean, every player wants to tweak things a little bit here and there, but when you start playing competitive golf on, whether it be a mini tour or on the PGA Tour, you've certainly aspired at a level that's unlike most amateur golfers. So the mental game becomes more and more important. What are some areas that you feel are your least effective right now that you're working on? And what are some of your, in other words, what are some of your strengths and what are some of your weaknesses, excuse me, on the mental side?
Yeah. I think that I have a very good mental game, a very strong mental game. I have a more holistic approach to the success or making it to the PGA Tour, and I mm-hmm. sometimes dig very deep in my soul. So for me, it's more like the question of the inherent self-belief. If I belong to the PGA Tour, if I'm comfortable on the PGA Tour with the way of living with the other guys,
right?
And because I've proven before that when the heat is on, I switch on all my mental skills, and I did it very first. I can win a tournament wire to wire. I've done it before, and I can pull it off. But to make it to the PGA Tour, it's a whole nother level of a mental skill. When we take Tiger Woods, for example, he never had a doubt in his mind that he was going to be the number one player in the world. It's just the way he was raised, and I was raised different, and I might be a little bit more of a gentleman, and some guys out there are more people who would do anything, sometimes even unfair things, to make it on the PGA Tour, and that's a different type of character. And so I'm working more on a deeper level of my game. I know that, you know, I can win tournaments. I can hold pressure pots. I have my mental skill sets. Dr. Nick taught me all of them, and I had most of them already. He basically, I think, just fine-tuned me and helped me access those skills under pressure or when I needed to. But for me, it's definitely more a deep thing in my soul that I just have to get over with. Some people say it comes with age. I'm 30 years old now, and most guys make it to the PGA Tour the first time when they're 32. So that's basically what I'm working on. I just want to wake up every morning and feel that I'm a PGA Tour player, and not have one single doubt in my mind, even if I play a mediocre round or something like that. So that's what I'm working on.
Fantastic. Nick, let me ask you, you know, how are you, because obviously when you're playing at that level, there's going to be more often than not, there's going to be disappointments out there on the tour. You're not going to win every tournament. What are some skills and what are some things that you're doing to help him handle the pressure of disappointment, because there are going to be disappointments out there.
Chris mentioned briefly inherent self-belief, and so what Chris and I have worked on is more kind of an Eastern perspective of the understanding of self. So this becomes a little bit more philosophical and existential, but it's a really important piece. So if you take a look at confidence, in a lot of Western athletes, it's based upon competencies, things that they've done.
Right.
Now, if you haven't made the last shot, if you haven't made the last cut, if you use a competency-based model for your confidence, then you're going to find it going up and down. And that's what happens with a lot of players. So a player who is going to have a stick-to-itiveness, and that's what I'm trying to assess and trying to predict which players are going to do this and how we're going to get them to that, we're looking to help a player develop what's called inherent self-belief, which means that it's not based upon just what you're doing. It's based upon the potentials that you have and you can bring to the course every time. And you
right.
know that you can't play golf based upon your last shot. So what Chris has been working on as a way to manage any of those disappointments is to know that he lets that go and he looks inside at a much deeper level about the potential that he has at a very high level. And if you look at Chris's resume, you'll see that he's done remarkably well in many tournaments. And that's what Chris
right.
is working on. So the best thing I can say, and for any of the listeners out there, is if you're making a judgment about how well you feel after your last shot, you're going to have a hard time being able to play very competitive golf. The
right.
emotions, in competition, although influence us, they're overrated. And what I mean by that is if you pay more attention to how you feel about your shot versus paying attention to the shot itself, you won't be able to develop the skill sets that's necessary to perform consistently because there's always going to be disappointing shots. Golf is not a perfect game. So even when I titled this that golf is not a game of confidence only, and what we try to do is pay attention more to decision-making. If you decide
right.
to pay attention to how you're going to bring the club through the ball versus how you feel about how you're going to bring the club through the ball, there's a major difference. And inherent self-belief is the kind of glue that kind of keeps things going with consistency, allowing you to let go of those shots and knowing that the potential continues to exist within you.
I have a pretty good example for that, Nick. Today, I played a local tournament here in Orlando, and we always talk about what factors are for me that internally distract me. And the last couple of days, I had to do a lot of organizational work on the computer with booking flights and tournament signups and organization, and it always stresses me out. I wish I could just work out, play golf, and sleep. But the first couple holes, I couldn't make my decisions in a way that I wanted to. And for some odd reason, I realized or I got aware that I'm not making strong, determined decisions and just go with it and learn from it and take it for the next shot. And then all of a sudden, I realized that on the fourth hole, and I decided without thinking about the consequence, just make one strong decision, take one shot and really determined, and then go with that and hit the shot. And I made, I think, 6 birdies in the next in the next 11 holes. I didn't finish very well, but it was just very clear again that the second a human being makes a strong decision and goes for it, the reward is right around the corner. So,
great example.
Fortunately, I got aware.
Yeah, excellent.
Sometimes I don't, and then, yeah.
Well, you know what, Chris, the thing is that, you know, there are always going to be, we talked about a little earlier when Dr. Nick first came on the show, we talked about, you know, external distractions and how we handle that. And there's always going to be things that we have to do. I mean, it would be a perfect world for those of us that love this great game if we could, you know, eat, sleep, and play golf. But there are other things outside of golf that we have to do, whether it be booking flights or making, schedules and so forth, that we have to do that sometimes get the better of us. But obviously those that are able to manage those outside distractions the best are the ones that are going to do, I think, well when they're playing. So keeping that theme, what are some things that you do when it comes to emotional recovery after a shot? If you've made a bad shot, let's say, or even if you've made a good shot, how do you handle them? Is there a difference between them? And what do you do after making each shot?
Yeah, I think a good cue for that would be to look at each shot as a preparation for the next shot. When some of my friends that, or some of my colleagues that might just be a pro for a year or two, they sometimes ask me, or they ask older players for advice, and I see a lot of guys, also amateurs, if their round doesn't go very well, after 14, 15 holes, they just keep finishing the golf round without any purpose. I started playing consistent golf, and I started to play good tournaments after good tournament when I realized that even if the tournament is already over, maybe I missed the cut already because I had no chance making five birdies in the last three holes to make the cut. But if I kept doing my routine, if I kept making good decisions, maybe all of a sudden something clicked again and I was able to transport it to the next tournament. And that goes also from shot to shot. So when I have a shot and it doesn't go very well and goes in the woods or in the trees or somewhere, I take that feeling, I save it somehow, and from there I try to improve. So, for example, if I hit a 7-iron 10 yards left, I try to save that feeling. Maybe the next hole, the pin is on the left back corner, and I just aim 10 yards to the right, and I play with that same shot because I can copy it. So that's how I learn from each shot. Sometimes a good shot is a good learning experience and opens a couple of birdies for the next couple of holes.
Exactly. Well said. Chris, let me also ask you, there obviously during the round you have to stay focused with the shots at hand. What do you do to not get too caught in the moment of the shot? Like, in other words, let's say during the round, as I talked about earlier, you've got 18 holes to play. When you're standing over and you're preparing for the shot, you have to be in the moment. You have to be in the zone, as they've said. What do you do in between shots to obviously you want to keep focused on the round at hand, but do you allow yourself to drift a little bit? Do you allow yourself to think about other things besides until the next shot comes along? Or what preparation do you do in between your shots?
I think it's healthy to learn to switch on and off. When I started playing professional golf, I had a tendency to keep my mind on the score for too long, and then sometimes I would burn out after 12, 13 holes. I think if someone would train himself to switch on for just a routine, which starts with assessing the lies and the wind and then doing the shot selection, and exactly what Nick probably told before about switching from external to internal and so forth, that's all you need to do. Sometimes, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. No, go ahead and finish your thought.
Basically, I think it's very healthy to switch off on purpose. Not too much. There's a fine line. If you joke around too much, you might break the tension of maybe a good streak of a couple holes. So I think you've got to find that out for yourself. Some people like to chat a lot. Some people like to be more quiet. I might be definitely a guy that's a little bit more quiet, especially when I play well. Some guys start talking a lot when they play well. I think you got to go out there and find a happy medium for yourself. It depends on your personality, I would say. But switching off between the shots is definitely something that I would recommend. But you got to learn it a little bit too. You got to try it out.
Exactly. And I would imagine, Chris, when you're playing in a non-competitive round, you're probably more like that. You're switched off a little bit more. I mean, you still want to, if you're playing with some friends or something, you still want to get the better of them. But at the same time, because you're not in a sudden death tournament, you obviously want to have a little bit more fun. There's less anxiety, less stress put on you. Would that be accurate?
That's very accurate, and it's also accurate for a tournament from Thursday throughout Sunday. If you play maybe with a good friend, you're paired up with a good friend on Thursday morning, on Friday, and you make the cut, and then the tension and the anxiety, and it all gets more and more. And, of course, if you have a winning putt on Sunday for a tournament, and while you walk onto the green, I don't think many players joke around it. So
no.
Then you're dialed in. So it builds. It's situational a little bit. Of course, I would it would be a gift to be as relaxed on a Sunday afternoon at the Masters to have a 10-foot putt for a birdie and the win, you know, just the way you would be if you're playing with your dad in a summer evening or something like that. But I don't think that would be human. I doubt that that's possible.
No. Well, I'm sure even with and using Tiger as a good example, when Tiger won his first Masters in 97, even though he had a 12-stroke lead over the field, I don't think he was skipping along the fairways. He still was in the moment. He was in the zone, if you will, until the very last putt went in, and then the emotions sort of flowed out. Is that kind of, if you were to compare yourself, is that kind of the style or way that you would play, is more like a Tiger Woods, where you're sort of in the moment through the tournament, but then once the final putt sank, then the sort of those emotions would then come out? Is that kind of along the same lines as you would categorize yourself?
Yeah, I would say so. I don't think I would, jump around and fist pump as much Tiger does a couple holes before, but I think I'm a little bit more like Henrik Stenson, who's kind of pretty
right.
quiet throughout, and then but then, of course, the celebration, everyone deserves that, and everyone's probably going a little bit crazy after a tournament win, but it's very important to also celebrate a lot and enjoy that moment, embrace it, and save it so you can have it later on again for the next moment that you need.
Well, I think also too, gentlemen, I think one thing that really has been lost in golf is that people need to remember that it is a game. You have to have fun along the way, and you have to, there's a time to be serious and in the moment, but there's a time to reflect and just enjoy the fact. It's a great game. It's a great personal experience and personal journey. As many people have said, it mimics life very much so. Some of the hills and valleys that we go through playing golf is very much similar to what we do in golf and in life, excuse me. Brian, let me bring you back in here. I didn't mean to leave you hanging out there, but Brian, as a teaching professional, you obviously see a lot of different types, and what's your assessment of Chris and the type of player that, I don't know how familiar you are with him, but and compared to some of the other players out there, how do you see his way of handling things compared to others that maybe at his level that you've seen?
Well, I've never met Chris before, but just listening to him speak, two things that caught my attention that I agree with. Chris tends to focus when he needs to hit a shot and then turn it off a little bit in between shots. I think that's great for any player. And it, the other thing that impressed me about Chris was when he talked about if he wasn't going to make a cut or play well, he was still focused on his routine and trying to find something good about a shot that could possibly carry over. And I think that's so important for amateurs that are listening. I see them tend to give up too soon on a round if it's not going their way. And if you can just stay in the moment and say, hey, let me see if I can hit this shot as good as I can, and just build from that. And I think that's just a great thought. So those two points right there for any player to grasp would definitely help their game.
Right,
yeah,
and I
jump
agree.
In for a yep. minute and
sure.
kind of add to this. Whether it's any of the players that have on a PGA Tour, LPGA, or the LET, or Symetra, or let's see, web.com, or mini tours, or juniors. One of the things that we do know is that there is this kind of predisposition that really is kind of biologically inherent about what affects your thresholds and emotions. And so knowing what I know about Chris, and clearly what I know about Brian, that their thresholds are very different. So I'm not
right.
expecting that kind of emotional reaction kind of seeps in and powers through and influences. Now, with some of the other players I see, no matter what the tours are on, what tour they're on, kind of inherent qualities, it's predisposition, it's inborn. They have to work and use their energy in another way. And that kind of sometimes takes away their focus. when I look at the energy, psychological energy in both of the players that we're talking about now, Brian and Prince, their energy is a pretty good amount, because it's not channeled into anxiety and anger like some other players have. And so when I do this testing and we make that assessment, I work with them very differently, because I don't have to spend as much energy on helping them manage their emotions. And particularly as we talk about, Chris brings up this inherent self-belief. He's working on this in another way. And what I know about Brian, for a longer period of time, he is also getting very close to that. With other players, because there's a tendency biologically, neurobiologically, their thresholds are lower. It's going to demand that they use more energy to regulate that. So that's a piece that most people don't even know. That's how we try to assess how we're going to work with the player.
Let's talk for a few moments, if we can, in preparation for a round. Nick, I'm going to start with you if I can, and then Brian, I'd like to get your perspective as a coach and a teacher, and then Chris, I'd like for you to sort of wrap it up with from a player's perspective. But Nick, talk about, if you will, what are some of the things that you do to help pre-round? In other words, a player that's getting ready to go out maybe and play a tournament next weekend, what are some things that you want them to be focusing on and working on in order to prepare?
Great. Well, first of all, we try to set up goals, and so the goals are, things that are going into the future, outcomes, like they either want to win the tournament or want to be in the top 10. Then we look at performance goals, greens and regulations, strokes gained, putts, and then we look at process goals. What do you have to do to get the ball there? Those are the kind of mechanical things, but clearly from my perspective, we look at the psychological stuff. So if a player is having trouble managing his attention, we set up goals about that. We set that up as a challenge. And then we look at the process about how to do that. So make sure that in your pre-shot, you're aware. I had a player, a very high-level player, who lost awareness in competition. And sometimes the ball was below her feet. She didn't even recognize that. So in that example,
right,
the goal would be aware of, and then we fill in the blank, be aware of your setup, be aware of the tension in your body, the tension in your mind. And so in this pre-competition preparation, we goal set, we identify the specific processes, and we put this into what's called the skills challenge balance. And if anybody's interested in looking at that book, Flow in Sports, by Jackson, and the co-author's name is hard for me to pronounce, so look up Susan Jackson, Flow in Sports, and that will show you the model that I use in pre-competition preparation.
Fantastic. Brian, from a teaching perspective, obviously you work with a lot of different students that are preparing for maybe in their own way a major tournament. Maybe it's a corporate event. Maybe it's a club championship. A lot of anxiety comes to the coaching table, if you will. What are some things that you do to try and prepare them and help them and guide them, if you will, to be able to handle those events a little bit better?
Well, with a lot of the players I deal with, I try to make sure they're aware of their own routine and not change it just because they're playing in an important event for them. I see a lot of players starting to take more lessons leading up to an event, or play more, or hit more balls, and they're breaking their own pattern. And I try to downplay that and say, listen, if that event was just another round of golf, would you be going through all this extra preparation? They always say no, and I said, I try to tell them, just be yourself, stick to your routine, and don't make it more than it's just another round of golf. And I think for the amateur player, that thought would work really well. Professional players tend to prepare a little bit differently. They need to have a game plan for the course and what shots they're going to hit, stuff like that. Most amateurs rev themselves up too much, and if we can keep them in their normal routine, I think that would definitely help them in the long run to perform better.
Well, and I think that's what kind of what I was getting at, where I was going earlier when I talked about, you know, the differences between somebody like a Freddie Couples and somebody like a Nick Price, two different, distinctly different styles of play. In other words, you know, you're not going to try and slow down a Nick Price to a Freddie Couples style or way of playing, because he's not going to be able to do it. It's going to take him out of his rhythm. And conversely, Freddie has a sort of a laid-back and easygoing style of play. You're not going to speed him up to play like a Nick Price. So, you know, that really goes to what you're talking about, I think, Brian, is, you know, a lot of people tend to, in preparation, especially at an amateur level, tend to get out of their normal routines and play a different game of golf, if you will, because the anxieties and the pressures are building. Is that pretty accurate, you think?
Yes, Ted. I think, like, if you're used to only hitting 10 or 12 balls before you round the golf, stick to that. Don't start hitting balls for a half an hour before you play. If you're used to just hitting a few putts and a few shots, try to stick to your routine, because you'll just feel more comfortable and then probably play a lot better. And then one other thing that I try to stress with my students, and Dr. Nick helped me with this, was, you know, satisfactory, intermediate, and dream goals. I think most amateurs go out into a round with a dream state of mind where today's going to be my best day, I'm going to shoot my best round, and it's too much pressure on the subconscious. And Dr. Nick taught me to, you know, if we can get our brain in the satisfactory or intermediate goal mindset, we probably have a better chance of playing to our peak performance. And a satisfactory round would be, you know, if you're used to shooting 80, that would be satisfactory. Intermediate might be a 77 or 76, and a dream might be, you know, 72, 73. And I think it's important for amateurs to recognize that, set that as a goal and try to stay in that satisfactory mindset, because if a couple bad shots or bad holes come along the way, you're really still in your comfort zone, so to speak. And I'm sure Dr. Nick can talk more about that, but I think most amateurs tend to always go out with these high expectations, and I think that just gets in their way of performing better.
Yeah, I agree. And Chris, let me ask you, Dr. Nick had raised made an interesting comment earlier with reference to, you know, sort of being in the moment and kind of losing oneself. First off, you know, obviously when you're out there playing week in, week out in different tournaments and that, there are going to be times that are going to come where you're going to kind of fall out of focus, if you will. What do you do at that point? What's the process that happens to you at that point? You're standing over a shot and suddenly it's like you're in a different world. How do you recover from that, and what do you do to go forward from there?
Yeah, in those moments, and they happen more often than they should. Some players just hit the golf ball and hope for the I observe myself a lot during my pre-shot routine. So I always ask myself the question, are you committed? Did you make the right decision? And if something is off, I feel it, because I can observe myself relatively well, and my emotions also. But the second I have a doubt feeling, or I might even go blank, on my best days when I'm in control of my mental game, I actually step completely away and start all over again. So I go behind the ball, even if it feels uncomfortable a little bit, because you might think, oh, what the other players are thinking, you start over again and you've done it already twice today. And if you're mentally strong, and if you realize that you're going blank, or if you realize that is not the best decision for you, then the only thing I can recommend is start all over again and really commit to your strong decisions. And if you do that, then you're usually not blank.
So your pre-shot routine then is sort of your go-to moment, if you will. In other words, if you're in a situation where you've, you know, momentarily had you know, gone blank, if you will, for lack of better words, that's what you do, is you take that step back and go through your routine again. And that's why you see so many times on television, you'll see a lot of the players will do that. You know, they'll be standing over a putt, or they'll be getting ready to take a shot, and all of a sudden they'll just back off, and everybody's kind of, you know, looking at themselves, what's he doing here? He was, you know, getting ready to hit the shot.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing in a sense, right?
Yeah. When you see the pros on TV, I think their strengths over the amateurs is the self-observation, and that's really the only thing you can do. I can, and in this moment right now, I cannot think of anything else that you could do. The routine makes a good golfer, maybe a 10 handicap, can, if someone has a better routine, can make somebody to a 5 or 3 handicap. The routine connects shots, good shots and good shots after each other. And if you're really consistent with your routine, you have the opportunity to become almost like a machine-like golfer. I think we've seen that with Martin Keimer this year.
Yeah.
When I observed him on TV, and I know him really well, since I'm 14, and I know how strong he is with his routine. He is just unflappable, and I knew the second he was playing the 65 in the first round of the U.S. Open, that if he just keeps his routine up, there's no way anybody's going to stop him. And that's something amateurs can learn from him. And that's why I enjoy watching golf on the PGA Tour. I don't care for their swings or they hold long putts, or anybody can do that. There's probably
right.
5,000 to 7,000 people on this planet who can hit it like a PGA Tour player. But what I enjoy is what's on their faces, like what are their expressions, how good is their routine under pressure, and that's something I think that's always a really, really good thing to do, to always reset yourself with a routine, and maybe, you know, instead of going onto the range for 100 golf balls or 200 golf balls, go onto the course and maybe get the video camera out with a friend. Look at yourself. How consistent is your routine? And if you're getting consistent with your routine, your mind's going to be consistent, and magically your shot's going to be consistent.
Well, I don't think I could have said it any better. And Chris, that was fantastic. And I know that the listeners are enjoying that. You know, I think one of the things that I've seen, and Brian, and I'm sure Nick, you would sense this as well, but I think with most amateurs, they spend way, way too much time on the physical part of the game and not enough time on the mental part. And if you look at most of the better players that have transcended through time on whether it be the PGA, LPGA, or what have you, they've always been very strong mentally. For instance, I use Jack Nicklaus as an example. Nicklaus, of course, certainly could hit a decent ball, but he was not one of the best ball strikers on the PGA Tour. But he was very mentally tough, very mentally strong, and able to manage his game in such a way that he could overcome whatever flaws he may have had in his actual physical part of his game. So if to leave some sort of parting thoughts, if you would, Nick, I would like you just to maybe instill some advice to those tuning into the program tonight on some of the things that they could be doing and working on, or what they should really be focusing on as opposed to just beating balls up at the range.
Okay, I'll give you some three basic imaginative techniques. I don't make the recommendation that Nicklaus does about seeing the ball, the flight of the ball. And the reason for that, that's
right.
The end result of how the ball actually gets struck. So we use a technique called external imagery. So if you've seen yourself on video camera, that's the image that I want golfers to really pay attention to, and to literally see what you look like when you're making a swing, not down the line, but kind of head on. So that's called external imagery. The next technique I use is mm-hmm. internal imagery, and this is used specifically for chips, pitches, and putts. And here I want you to imagine what your eyes would see if you could see the blade at the correct angle coming through the chip and the putt, how far the club comes back and how it comes through the ball for 2 inches in front of it. And the third technique, which is the most powerful, is proprioception. And both of these guys that have joined me on the show know this very well. It's the feel that you have. So imagine taking driver back and feel the weight of the club in your hand, feel your shoulder turn, feel your hips, and feel the compression as you bring the club through the ball. that proprioception is firing in your brain to the muscles in real time in spite of the fact that you haven't even moved your arms or your legs. Those techniques are very powerful techniques, and if you can learn how to use those, and I say 10 minutes a day of each one of those, calculating 1.3 to 1.5 seconds, you can see how many swings that you're going to make mentally. And that's what you're going to do before you strike the ball. You take that to the course, and you're going to play a lot better.
And again, thank you for joining me tonight on the program, Nick. I appreciate that. Brian, thank you for helping put this together. And Chris, thank you for joining us as well. And unfortunately, guys, I mean, I could go on for another hour here, but unfortunately we're out of time. But I want to certainly thank you, Dr. Nick Molinaro, for joining me tonight on Golf Talk Live.
Thanks for the invitation.
And sharing,
thank you.
Some thoughts. And actually, Nick, I'm going to extend another invitation. I would like you to come back. I'm working on a new series. I was talking about it earlier, part of the Coach's Corner series called Planning for Success. And we're going to be covering a lot of key components of becoming a better golfer. And, of course, one of them is going to be in the mental side. And I think I would love to have you take part in that process and join the panel discussion. We're going to have a great discussion on that. So I'll give you some more details in the future. But, Nick, I want to thank you for coming on tonight and talking about that. And there's just really not enough time to cover everything. But you're certainly welcome to come back here anytime and share it.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Ted. It would be my pleasure to come back to your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And Brian, of course, Brian Dobby, PGA Teacher Professional up in the New Jersey area, thank you for coming on the show. And again, thank you for introducing me to Nick. And I'm expecting you, of course, to be part of the process and come back on the show as well.
Ted, anytime you need me, you know you can give me a call. I appreciate all the times you've had me on, and Dr. Nick is awesome, and if anybody in the New Jersey area is listening, seek him out because he can definitely help your golf game. Thanks again, Ted.
And for sure. Not a problem. And, of course, our player, Chris Trunzer, thank you very much for joining us as well. And I would like you to also extend an invitation for you to come back on the program. I'd love to hear as you continue to make your journey as a player, would love to certainly have updates and have you come on and share. I think it's great to have not only the coach's experience, but it's also great to have a player's perspective as well to share with the audience. I think they can learn a lot from you as well. So, Chris, you're welcome to come back and continue some discussion with us here on Golf Talk Live.
Yeah, thank you very much. Again, I really appreciate it being on the show. It's very exciting for me, and I hope we talk soon. Absolutely.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Chris, and much continued success on your quest in the PGA Tour. And, gentlemen, thank you. Have a great evening. And Dr. Nick Molinaro, thank you for joining me tonight on Golf Talk Live.
Thanks again, Ted. Look forward to speaking with you soon.
Bye, guys.
All right, not a problem. Have a great evening, guys.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay. Just as we wind down the last moment or two here on the show, I want to give a special thank you again to my guests, Dr. Nick Molinaro, a sports psychologist up in the New Jersey area. And you can find out more about him on his website at www.vantagesportspsychology.com. You can learn more about Nick and some of the great things that they're doing there. And also for Brian Dobby, PGA Teacher Professional, for joining us as well. And PGA from Germany, Chris Trunzer, for joining us as well. He's also a mini tour player and on his quest for the becoming a player on the PGA Tour. So thank you as well, Chris, for joining us. And don't forget to tune in each and every Thursday at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time, live right here on blogtalkradio.com/golftalklive. And we always will do our best to try and help you become a better player. Thanks to all the people that support the program, Jonathan Laird at South Coast Golf Guide, Meredith Kirk, Vicki and Tiffany Litherland, Bernie Pinder of Ontic Golf, and Mr. Peter Doyle of Doyle Golf Solutions over in Ireland. Don't forget to join me every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time for the Women of Golf, where I am joined by none other than LPGA professional Cindy Miller, hosting the Women of Golf show that's geared for you ladies out there. Have a great weekend, everybody. I hope you enjoy the show, and I will see you back here next week, right here, Thursday at 6 p.m. Central, right here on Golf Talk Live. Thanks, everybody. God bless, and have a great weekend.